Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. All right, guys, let's get to it. Just a bit of house cleaning stuff. We got a massive response. I was kind of surprised on the Gary Sampson episode. And I say I'm surprised is because the media usually gives this case a big leaving alone. I don't know if it's the fact that he tried to turn himself in. It seems like beating up on the Boston FBI, and they've taken a lot of beatings in the past few years, and most of them deserved. I just wanted to say thank you for all the emails on this case. It is a crazy case. And going forward, I just wanted to ask you guys a favor if I could. I'm looking to do a story on the Great Plymouth Mail Truck Robbery of 1962. This was a massive score, guys, and I know nothing about it. I've heard it mentioned from time to time, but I really know nothing about it. If you know something about it, or if you know someone who does, some inside information, I need to scoop on this case. It's so old, there's not much in the media. So Google the Great Plymouth Mail Truck Robbery and see if anything rings a bell with you. The best I can ascertain is millions were taken and not a single arrest and not even a whiff of suspects. But I may be off base. Send me an email at barry@bostonconfidential.net. That's barry@bostonconfidential.net. Also, I have another idea for a story going forward. It's really a homework assignment, guys. I'm going to give you a homework assignment to watch something on Netflix. It's the Trial 4. That's the title of the movie. Trial 4. It's about Sean Ellis and his execution murder of a Boston police officer. I know we all know about it in the greater Boston area, but now I have a nationwide, or actually a worldwide, audience for Boston Confidential. Some good news there. But watch Trial 4 about Sean Ellis. I've had a real problem lately with documentaries on Netflix. They're just so one-sided. They're so defendant-sided. I have a hard time taking them seriously, quite frankly. And the first one I'd point out is Making a Murderer. I know that made a big splash. A lot of that was proven to be inaccurate, guys, massively inaccurate. And it's so one-sided, I feel like I'm sitting in a grand jury where the prosecution only gets to talk. But on the other side, on these Netflix shows, only the defense gets to talk because the prosecutors have to save their arguments for court, right? I just been having a real problem with Netflix shows lately, especially crime-related ones. So, all right, guys, you have a homework assignment. We'll do the show by the end of the month, by like the 28th or so. But your homework assignment is to go watch Trial 4, take some notes, email me. We'll go back and forth. I'll do the show. I remember the case. I didn't think it was that close of a call in this case. So we'll go from there. All right, guys, I think I have kind of a short episode for you this week because there's really no information on this case, or just not much information in the public domain on this case. And this is the horrendous murder of Jack and Jerry McGee out of Andover. And that happened in December 2011. This is an extremely interesting story, and there's some twists and turns in it and some intentional misdirection, or at least attempted misdirection, I guess is the right word. But let me start where we usually start. I'll take you from the background information of these two fine people. By all accounts, they're great people. Jack McGee, he owned McGee Construction, and he inherited that business from his father. Surprisingly, the business name is McGee Construction. And what they did was high-end residential homes in the Andover, Massachusetts area. in Andover, Massachusetts. It's relatively close to the New Hampshire border on Massachusetts' North Shore. It's a very well-heeled community. I guess the right word is Tony. It's a Tony community. It's commuting distance from southern New Hampshire and Boston, Massachusetts. Andover's a great community. Is it rich? I'd say yes. One of the richer communities in Massachusetts. I guess the firm started out as regular residential builders, but then they morphed into the luxury residential building market, and they were known all over Boston's North Shore and up to the New Hampshire border as well. It's a very well-known company. Everybody loved Jack, and whomever met Geraldine, his wife, loved her as well. They were that couple that was always together. They had done well financially. They had built their own mansion where they lived. And this was not a cookie cutter mansion. This was a custom home built by Jack himself. And Jack had also built the other homes in this development. And this development was called Orchard Crossing. And it's beautiful. They knew all their neighbors. They all knew each other in this little enclave. And it was definitely a rich enclave. Don't get me wrong. Couple also owned a beautiful home. I don't know if this one was a mansion in Florida, Jupiter, Florida. And just before they passed, they had returned home from Florida. I think what was happening in the family was Jack and Jerry were in the process of turning this business over to their son. All right, guys, I'll tell you a little bit more about the McGee family when we come back from this commercial break. Stand by. Hey guys, just wanted to give a shout out to this week's sponsor, Podcorn. Podcorn's a marketplace for podcasters and advertisers. The ease of use of this product is absolutely insane. If I can do it, you can do it. You just fill out the prompts on the website and then you bid on whom you want to advertise with. It's that simple. And everybody wants to know about getting paid. Don't be afraid to think about that. Getting paid is the easiest thing. I've been paid sometimes within hours. There must be an algorithm with Podcorn because as soon as my podcast posts, the money's deposited in my account. It's that simple. And you never lose any creative control with Podcorn. I think listeners of Boston Confidential would agree. I would never give up an ounce of creative control, and they don't ask you to. It's that simple. But with other products in the podcasting world, you have to be cognizant of that. Podcorn leaves creative control right where it belongs with the podcaster. All right, guys, Podcorn, check them out. So the McGees had two kids. The boy was John. I don't know if he's a junior, but there was a younger sister as well, Holly. Her surname now is, I'm going to butcher this name, I know, Senyakov. Holly Senyakov. I don't believe it. I got it right, I think. Okay, so that's Holly's name. Now, both the kids were involved in the business growing up, you know, various office jobs or whatever, but John was set to take this over. He was in the construction business, and they were both adults by this time that this horror show arrived in 2011. But there's really no history of trouble, even with this company. They're a construction company, and they're involved in the real estate business. They really had a sterling reputation. You would think there'd be a ton of litigation, because there usually is with construction companies, especially people that build homes, because that's the first person a homeowner turns to sue. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of disputes with this company. During my research, I didn't come up with anything in terms of, there's always somebody who's pissed off at you in business. There doesn't seem to be a hell of a lot with McGee Construction. It's just strange. So by all the accounts I've read, the kids had a normal upbringing. Don't get me wrong. I know they were rich and, you know, that's a good thing, right? Dad worked hard all his life and his father did before him as well. And they were enjoying the fruits of that labor. Geraldine, or Jerry as she called, she was the mom. She started out as a school teacher in Billerica, Massachusetts, which is a nearby community. Pretty quickly after her own kids came along, she became a homemaker, and I believe she helped out with the business periodically. She eventually became a realtor in the area as well, so she continued the family tradition in the housing business, I guess. Hey guys, I just want to give a quick shout out to this week's sponsor, Liquid Death. What is Liquid Death, you ask? Is this some new fire water? A flavored vodka? A tequila, perhaps? No, this is just water in cans. And this company is kind of punk rock. They have a weird sense of humor. You're going to want to check them out. The water in the cans is actually from a mountain, so no BS there. So what Liquid Death is trying to do is to reduce pollution through the use of aluminum cans rather than plastic bottles. We all see these plastic bottles, straws, and all this being pulled out of our oceans. One of the things that people really don't know about plastics is when it's recycled, it's a secondary effort. It comes back as floor mats, whatever, and those products also end up back in the landfills. Aluminum is a primary recycling effort, and when it comes back as another aluminum product. Something I just learned, the average aluminum can contains 70% recycled materials as opposed to plastic, which only contains 3% recycled materials. So aluminum is definitely the way to go. Currently, you can purchase Liquid Death at Whole Foods and 7-Eleven. You can also purchase directly from the website, and that's what I recommend doing because I got something for you guys. I was able to score a prize for you. If you go to Liquid Death and put a case of water in your shopping cart, and when you purchase it, you'll get two free koozies. Just punch in Boston Confidential, one word, all caps. Punch that into the promo code section, and you'll get your two free koozies. This company's kind of bringing a sense of humor to the water industry, and it's doing it well. Check it out, guys. Liquid Death, liquiddeath.com. Hey guys, just a quick commercial break. Wanted to tell you about a new sponsor we have, Cookies for Breakfast. It's a new podcast by Spark Tabor, the comedian. If you haven't seen Tabor's stuff online, check it out. He's all over the place. He is on YouTube, Twitter. But this podcast is relatively new, Cookies for Breakfast. It's a comedy podcast. Guys, I know we all get bogged down too much in this true crime world we're in. Take a break. Listen to Spark Tabor, Cookies for Breakfast. I've listened to a couple episodes. It's phenomenal. It's everyday conversation, and we kind of all need that right now. And he is just absolutely hilarious. If you want some insight as to what the pod's going to be like, just research some of his stand-up material. He goes heavily into dating, pop culture, and just everyday stuff. It's absolutely hilarious, and the way he blends one topic into another. It's just kind of a stream of consciousness. It's an excellent podcast, guys. Cookies for Breakfast. It's available on Apple and wherever else you get your podcast. Check them out, guys. All right, guys. I guess I'll take you through the horrible case details of this infamous case. So it's mid-December 2011, and things were going the way they always were for the McGee family. They had just returned home from Florida, and Jack was in the office. The business had an office in the lower level of the McGee's mansion. So it's December 13th, and Jack goes out to a construction site with his son. He's looking at some property they were developing or were about to develop. He had a conversation with his son. His son was due to take his pickup truck, the dad's pickup truck, into Boston because he needed to pick up some specialized building materials. So father and son meet during the day at the construction site. Later in the day, they meet again back at the home office. The son's there looking at some plans for the next day of the development they were building, and he was preparing, you know, a route to go into Boston to pick this stuff up with the pickup truck. There was also another employee around, and he insisted on cleaning this pickup truck because I guess it was legendarily dirty. So this employee cleans it before the son goes in to pick up building supplies, and everything seems to be just a normal day. So I'm going to give you the best timeline I can. This is from December 13th. At about 4:30, John and Jack were both home at the office, and I believe shortly thereafter, John, the son, left in the pickup truck, which has now been cleaned, to go pick up the aforementioned supplies. Jack is home at the house with Jerry. So Jerry calls Holly, the daughter, at about 4:25 p.m. And she was setting up a time. The kids were going to come over. I think it was a every Wednesday type of deal. And mom watched her grandkids while the daughter did whatever. But on this specific instance, on this Tuesday, they were making plans for Wednesday because Holly was going to go Christmas shopping. Christmas was right around the corner. So it was kind of like she was going to drop the kids off and go out and buy their presents and whatnot. Holly, for her part, would later testify that she heard her dad's voice in the background. So both mom and dad were home at this point, and I believe the son, John, had departed for Boston at that time. So again, this was just another day in the life of the McGee family. Holly goes over to the house the next morning and finds a complete horror show, and I have to tell you what it was. She walks in at about 9:19 a.m. on Wednesday, December 14th, 2011. Now, I know I've mentioned before, other cold cases, the police really keep a clamp on the information. In this one, the clamp is fastened super tight, guys. But I'm going to tell you what I have so far. I've heard varying reports of where the bodies were found. It's always the first floor, but some people say it's the garage, it's the basement, or another room in the first floor. But what Holly sees when she arrives at the house is her mother shot in the back of the head towards the neck, and her father shot multiple times in the head, chest, and neck as well, I believe. And they were laying head to head, so their heads were facing each other, almost touching, and feet spread apart. I've heard varying accounts of all the brass, all the cartridges from the bullets were picked up and removed. So basically, the shell casings were picked up. That indicates a level of professionalism in this murder, double murder. But I've also heard reports that some brass, some of the cartridges were recovered. So that's a question mark. But there seems to be a level of professionalism in these homicides. And let me tell you what happened the day before. The McGee's luxury Lexus SUV was found at about 10:20, I believe it was, in Boston's North End, specifically on Prince Street in the North End. And for those of you who are not from the metropolitan Boston area, the North End is and was the seat of power for the Italian Mafia. And specifically, Prince Street is where Jerry Angiulo ran his criminal enterprise that stretched all the way through Massachusetts. And the police believe this was an attempt to implicate Boston organized crime in this double homicide. Two rich people involved in real estate. Could the mob be far behind? I think that's what the killer wanted you to think. Because quite frankly, if you were involved with the Italian mob in Boston, the last place you'd ditch a motor vehicle that you had just stolen and committed a double homicide for would be the North End. You would be rubbed out. I'm sorry, that's a level of stupid that even the Boston mob couldn't handle. So when you pick up all the bullets, the casings, it's called policing your brass. So they picked up all the brass. And that indicates this may have a level of professionalism. But the dumping of the car the night before gives me a sense of false professionalism in this, because it was just weird, right? The mob wasn't involved in this. If the mob did it, the last neighborhood that vehicle would be on Prince Street. And you're going to light a fire on Prince Street in the North End? They would literally machine gun you for that. Even if you weren't connected to homicide, okay? So there's some professionalism and some, I guess, semi-professionalism there. So I don't know what's going on in this case yet. The police seem to think that the McGee's knew whoever came to their house because there's no signs of a struggle. They're kind of laid out, prone, head to head. And I guess you could walk up with a handgun and say, okay, you know, tell these people what to do. But it seems like there wasn't much of a struggle. It seems like the McGee's thought they were going to ride this out. But Jack McGee was getting old. He was 69. Jerry was 67. So fighting wasn't really an option here. So if they pull a gun, maybe it's somebody they don't know, but maybe the police. I'm sure the police know more than I do on this case. And believe me, there's not many details released in this case. And again, I'm just flummoxed, but the police, I believe, do have evidence to go on. They did a forensic search of all of their business dealings. Everything seems to be in order. They seem to be meticulous record keepers. They pay their bills. They have an A-plus credit line. All the things you'd get killed over, they're out of that demographic. You know, there's no drugs. There's no money problems. There's no fighting between husband and wife. The son was literally in the process of taking over this business. His dad was giving it to him. And the daughter wasn't cut out. I don't think money was a problem in this family. I think it was evenly distributed, and it seemed to be pretty harmonious there. So I believe the police are looking at a window from about 4:30, 4:25 on the evening of December 13th, when Holly heard both of her parents home. She was speaking to her mother directly and heard her father puttering around in the background. So from about 4:25, 4:30 on, they found the car in the north end burning, I believe at about 10:20, between 10:20 and 10:30 p.m. And it's about, I'd say it's about a solid hour from Andover into Boston. So that leaves from about 4:30 to what, maybe, I don't know, 9:30-ish. It's a small window. So the police do what they naturally do in these cases. They start from the victims and work their way out through the social circle, family, and all that. And what they found was kind of people just like them. You know, they were good at this business. They paid their bills. People liked working for them. Jerry was active at St. Teresa's Catholic Church. That took up a lot of her time. So I just don't think there's a lot of glaring inconsistencies in their life. And I think the police thought they were going to find it through this business, because when there's a lot of money involved in the construction industry, people can get angry. But again, there wasn't a lot of litigation from this family's business. I don't know. It's a big question mark. Again, there's not a lot of information in the public domain for this case. That's also a question mark. Again, I question that theory, that thought process, where we continue to keep such a tight lip on all the facts in this case. It's 10 years since this case happened, right? And it gets colder every day. But I try to read between the lines in the police investigation. I think the police chief at one point said he had involved 4 states and 20 cities and towns during this investigation. He said he is also working with the FBI, Homeland Security, and the DEA. So they must have some traction. That's what I'm thinking. Well, maybe traction's not the right word, at least a theory. Because, I mean, would you involve all those agencies and all those states if there wasn't an investigative trail to follow? I'd think not. So I think they're working something. What it is, who knows? Something that struck me in this case, I don't know if anybody else knows. I know you're all true crime nuts like me. There was a kind of a similar case in Canada. I don't know in which province, but 2 billionaires were found horribly murdered in their massive mansion, much bigger than the McGee's. But it was, there's some striking similarities there. I don't know if anybody had picked that up. Okay, that Canadian case was Barry and Bunny Sherman out of Toronto, and that occurred in 2017, and they were horribly murdered. And there seems to be a family connection in that case, so I don't know if it's a direct correlation to the McGee case here today. But I think the police at one point were really looking at ties to the Jupiter, Florida home. They had recently purchased a home, I'm assuming it's a mansion, in an upscale section of Jupiter. And I think it's all pretty upscale in Jupiter. I think Jupiter is north of Palm Beach, and it's a very nice area on the coast. And there seemed to be some investigative activity focused around that house. And I just don't know what they ever came up with. You know, you look to anniversaries in this case, 3 years, 5 years. Do the police release any new information. Man, and this one, they just don't. There's nothing new. And I know I sound like a broken record on this, but is this working where we release no new information on these cases? And sometimes I know there isn't anything new, but I think in most cases there's something. You've got to generate some interest in these cases online. Get it out to the public. Get it on YouTube, Facebook. That's where people's eyes are these days. And I think the police miss a hell of an opportunity. They have 20th century thought process on that, and we're in the 21st century, and they got to catch up. So there's really been nothing new in this case. The son, John, took over McGee Construction, and I don't know what part Holly plays in that or if she plays any part in it at all, but they're kind of quiet too. I would expect more from a double homicide victim's family in terms of visibility. It's kind of strange. And I don't mean to cast aspersions on it, but they're very quiet. You know, I've interviewed a lot of people since starting this podcast, and I've talked to even more, and they want to keep this in the news. Nobody really seems to want to do that in this case. It's a little off-putting. There's just not the publicity on this case you think there would be. It's a major whodunit. I mean, this has got so many question marks. You got family where there's love. You get the business where there's money, where there are marital problems. You know, all the stuff that make a great murder mystery are inherent in this case, and everybody's just looking to see which way it goes. But the press, again, kind of like the Gary Sampson case, in my opinion, seem to avoid this case. This has happened in 2011, so that's 10 years now, guys. Nothing new. No updates, no Facebook. And again, I'm not casting aspersions on the family. I'm just saying they're kind of quiet. Police are super quiet and tight-lipped. It's just a strange case. I wonder if there'll ever be a break in it. And there was nothing else missing from this crime scene, this in this beautiful mansion. It seems like a straight-out hit, right? Nothing else. There was stuff to take. It was a mansion. And I guess they took the vehicle the day before. But that seems part of a ruse now, right? So many question marks in this case and little evidence, right? All right, guys, I told you that was going to be a quick episode. There's just not a lot of evidence in this case. But if you want to get a hold of me on this one or the other stuff we talked about, your homework assignment, don't forget your homework assignment. Give me a shout at Barry@BostonConfidential.net. That's Barry@BostonConfidential.net. And I will see you on the flip side.